And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, if you notice, I didn't do a show yesterday. I've been incredibly ill. This morning I felt great. And today is September 18th, 261st day of the year. Leap year is 262. 104 days left to the end of the year. And what a year it's been. Well, on this date in 1896, Nerva is proclaimed Roman Emperor after Domitian is assassinated. 324, Constantine the Great decisively defeats Licinius in the Battle of Hierapolis, establishing Constantine's sole control over the Roman Empire. Constantine ruled with two others. One was his own father-in-law, and he wanted power. He's also the one that decided Christianity would be the main religion of Rome. And basically set up the meeting that determined what was going to be taught in this religion. 1048, the Battle of Capitron between a combined Byzantine Georgian army and a Seljuk army. 1066, Norwegian King Harald Hardrada lands with Tostig Godwinson at the mouth of the Humber River and begins his invasion of England. 1180, Philip Augustus becomes King of France. He was at all of 15 years old when it was decided he was the king. 1454, in what's known as the 13 Years' War. In the Battle of Kozienice, the Polish army is defeated by the Teutonic Knights. For those that are not familiar with all the groups, the Teutonic Knights were the German version of the Knights Templar. 1759, French and Indian War. The Articles of Capitulation of Quebec are signed. 1793, first cornerstone of the United States Capitol laid by George Washington. I've seen the painting of him doing that. He's wearing a Masonic emblem. ...1809... Royal Opera House in London opens up. 1810... the first government junta in Chile. It was supposed to rule only during the Peninsular War with Spain. It's, in fact, the first step toward independence from Spain, and it's commemorated in Chile as such. In 1812, the 1812 Fire of Moscow dies down after destroying more than three-quarters of the city. Napoleon returns from the Petrovsky Palace to the Moscow Kremlin, which is one of the few major structures spared from the fire. 1837, Tiffany & Company, which was first Tiffany & Young, is founded by Charles Lewis Tiffany and Teddy Young in New York City. The store is called a stationery and fancy goods emporium. Of course, pretty soon he jettisoned Young, and it became just Tiffany's. 1838, the Anti-Corn Law League is established by Richard Cobden. 1850, U.S. Congress passes the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. 1851, the first publication of New York Daily Times, which later becomes the New York Times, and it went steadily downhill from there. 1862, Confederate States celebrate for the first and only time a Thanksgiving Day. 1864, John Bell Hood, Confederate General, begins the Franklin-Nashville campaign in an unsuccessful attempt to draw William Tecumseh Sherman back out of Georgia. It failed, and eventually Hood's army is totally destroyed. 1870, the Old Faithful geyser is seen and named by Henry D. Washburn. 1872, King Oscar II takes the throne of Norway, Sweden. 1873, the bank J. Cook & Company declares bankruptcy, which helped start the financial panic of 1873. 1879, the Blackpool Illuminations are switched on for the first time. For those that aren't familiar with those, it's an annual light festival held each autumn in the British seaside resort of Blackpool on the Fildy Coast in Lancashire. Known locally as the Lights or the Illumination, they run each year for 66 days, from late August until early November, the time when most other English seaside resort seasons are coming to an end. They're 6.2 miles long and use over 1 million bulbs. Basically, it was a way to draw more people there. They were described as artificial sunshine, and at the time consisted of 8 carbon arc lamps. The original event preceded Thomas Edison's patent of the electric light bulb by a year. First display similar to the modern day displays was held in May of 1912 to mark the first British royal family visit to Blackpool when Princess Louise opened a new section of the promenade. It's called the Princess Parade. Well, every year there's also the Festival of Light, which features interactive installations and is described as being a contemporary look at the concept of light and art working together. Basically, it was to draw people, which was a brilliant idea. Okay, 1882, the Pacific Stock Exchange opens. 1895, the Atlanta Exposition speech on race relations is delivered by none other than Booker T. Washington. 1898, the Fashoda incident triggers the last war scare between Britain and France. Now, for those that are not familiar with the Fashoda incident, it was a climax of imperial territorial disputes between Britain and France in East Africa, and it occurred in 1898. A French expedition to Fashoda on the White Nile River sought to gain control of the Upper Nile River basin and exclude the British from the Sudan. The French party and a British Egyptian force, which outnumbered the French by 10-1, met on what were deemed friendly terms, but back in Europe it precipitated a war scare. Now, the British held firm as both empires stood on the verge of war with heated rhetoric on both sides. But under heavy pressure, the French withdrew, ensuring Anglo-Egyptian control over the area. And eventually there was an agreement signed between the two powers that recognized the status quo. It was a diplomatic victory for the British, as the French realized in the long run they needed the friendship of Britain in case of a war between France and Germany, which turned out to be the case. In 1906, a Hong Kong typhoon killed an estimated 10,000 people. 1911, Russian Premier Pyotr Stolypin is shot at the Kiev Opera House. 1914, the Irish Home Rule Act becomes law, but it's delayed until after the end of World War I. 1919, the Vereniging achieves its objective of women's suffrage in the Netherlands. 1919, Fritz Pollard becomes the first African American to play professional football with a major team, the Akron Pros. 1922, the Kingdom of Hungary is admitted to the League of Nations. Now, the League of Nations was an exercise of futility, clearly. 1939, Polish government of Ignacy Moskicki flees to Romania. Also in 1939, the radio show Germany Calling begins transmitting Nazi propaganda. 1940, the British liner SS City of Benares is sunk by German submarine U-48. Among those killed were 77 child refugees. 1943, Adolf Hitler orders the deportation of Danish Jews. 1944, the British submarine HMS Tradewind torpedoes Yun Yo Maru, kills 5,600, mostly slave laborers and POWs. 1944, the Battle of Arracourt begins. 1945, General Douglas MacArthur moves his headquarters from Manila to Tokyo. 1947, the National Security Act reorganizes the U.S. government's military and intelligence services. There are many that say this was done in response to what's become known as the Roswell incident. Certainly, it happened within a short period of time. 1948, Operation Polo is terminated after the Indian Army accepts the surrender of the Army of Hyderabad. 1948, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine becomes the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate without completing another senator's term. Fidel Castro arrives in New York City as the head of the Cuban delegation to the United Nations. 1961, UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld dies in an air crash while attempting to negotiate peace in the Katanga region of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. 1962, Burundi, Jamaica, Rwanda, Trinidad and Tobago admitted to the United Nations. 1973, the Bahamas, East Germany, and West Germany are admitted to the United Nations. 1974, Hurricane Fifi strikes Honduras with 110 mile per hour winds, kills over 5,000 people. 1977, Voyager 1 takes the first distant photograph of the Earth and the Moon together. 1980, Soyuz 38 carries two cosmonauts to the Salyut 6 space station. And one of those cosmonauts was Cuban. 1981, the Assembly Nationale votes to abolish capital punishment in France. 1982, the Sabran Shatila massacre in Lebanon comes to an end. 1984, Joe Kittinger completes the first solo balloon crossing of the Atlantic. 1988, the uprising in Myanmar comes to an end. 1990, Liechtenstein becomes a member of the United Nations. 1992, an explosion rocks giant mine at the height of labor disputes, killed 9 replacement workers in Yellowknife, Canada. Those replacement workers were referred to as scabs. They broke the picket line. 1997, U.S. media magnate Ted Turner donates $1 billion to the United Nations. 1997, the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention is adopted. 2001, first mailing of anthrax letters from Trenton, New Jersey in the 2001 anthrax attacks. 2007, Buddhist monks join anti-government protesters in Myanmar, starting what became called the Saffron Revolution. 2011, the 2011 Sikkim earthquake felt across northeastern India, Nepal, Bhutan, Bangladesh, and southern Tibet. 2012, Greater Manchester police officers, PC Nicola Hughes and PC Fiona Bone, are murdered in a gun and grenade ambush attack in Greater Manchester. 2014, Scotland votes against independence from the UK by 55% to 45%. 2015, 2 security personnel, 17 worshippers in a mosque, and 13 militants are killed during a Tehrik-i-Taliban Pakistan attack on a Pakistan Air Force base on the outskirts of Peshawar. 2016, the 2016 Uri attack in Jammu and Kashmir, India by terrorist group Jaish-e-Mohammed results in the death of 19 Indian Army soldiers and all 4 attackers. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances: Christian Feast Day, Constantius in the Theban Legion, Edward Bouvier Bousset, Episcopal Church, Eustorgius I, Joseph Copertino, Juan Macias, Methodius of Olympus, Ricardus, Day of National Music in Azerbaijan, Island Language Day in Okinawa Prefecture in Japan, National Day in Chile, National HIV AIDS and Aging Awareness Day in the U.S., Navy Day in Croatia, and World Water Monitoring Day nationally. All right, let's see what else we got. 1811, British East India Company force led by Baron Minto conquers Java, part of the Dutch East Indies. Stamford Raffles appointed lieutenant governor. The Great Fire of Moscow that I referenced earlier, which happened under Napoleon, burned for 5 days, destroyed 75% of the city, and over 12,000 people died. Okay. 1931, to create a pretext for the invasion of Manchuria and China, a railway explosion is faked by the Japanese. 1951, A Streetcar Named Desire, directed by Elia Kazan and starring Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh, is released. Greta Garbo's birthday was on this date. James Gandolfini, Lance Armstrong. Government of Uttar Pradesh in India confirms 2.3 million people applied for 238 menial office jobs on this date in 2015. And for those that wondered if Arthur Conan Doyle was married, in 1907 he married Jean Elizabeth Leckie. Okay, what else we got? This is the date in history when Jimi Hendrix died. Died in 1970. Okay, let's see what else. In 1437, the peasant uprising in Transylvania. 1502, Christopher Columbus lands at Costa Rica on his fourth and last voyage. 1544, English King Henry VIII's troops occupy Boulogne. In 1544, the Peace of Crepy is signed by Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and the French King Francis I, ending the Fourth Habsburg-Valois War. In 1755, Fort Ticonderoga in New York opens up. 1769, John Harris of Boston builds the first spinet piano. 1851, when the New York Times started publishing, it was 2 cents a copy, which was still more than it was worth. 1852, Jay Cook and Company, their collapse caused such a panic, it was the government bond agent. Which means it should have had all the money it needed for everything. 1898, Lord Kitchener's ships reached Fashoda in the Sudan. 1914, General Paul von Hindenburg, named commander of the German armies on the Eastern Front. And on that note, we're going to stop with the past and talk about Children of the Night, which is what we were talking about in our last show. You know, in addition to black cats and black dogs, there's also been stories about shapeshifters. And up until the end of season 4 of The Walking Dead, we were familiar with seeing our heroes hunkered down in a fortified Georgia prison doing battle with the dead and their archvillain, the one-eyed governor. But the resurrected dead, people who feed on people, and prisons have a place in the real world. However, when you talk about the children of the night, you're taking a step across the line into almost an alternate reality. In the latter part of the 16th century, London's Newgate Prison was the site of a horrific series of deaths that would have made even the average undead proud in the extreme, if such creatures possess significant numbers of brains to be proud. Due to pronounced lack of regular food, on more than a few occasions, the prisoners targeted the weakest members of the pack and turned them into food. Very much like a case of having to eat the living to avoid becoming one of the dead. In other words, we're talking about cannibals in a cell block. One of those savagely killed and partially eaten by the prisoners was an unnamed man who did exactly what the bitten and equally semi-devoured at a prison of the Walking Dead did on so many occasions. He got up again. Not, however, as a voracious devotee of raw human flesh, but as a ghastly, ghostly black dog with a pair of blazing red eyes. Now, the actions of this undead man, or hound, or whatever you want to call him, were not at all unlike those of its televised-based equivalents. The creature violently slaughtered all those who had taken its human life by savagely biting down on their necks with its immense and powerful jaws. And of course, death swiftly followed for the guilty parties. They did not, however, get reanimated. When the deed was done, the spectral man dog vanished, never to be seen again. And then there's the similar and strange tale of a pair of brothers, William and David Souter. Their story began late one night in December 1728 when William, a Scottish farmer, was hard at work in his fields and heard an unearthly shriek that was accompanied by a brief glimpse of a large, dark-colored dog, far bigger than any normal hound he'd ever seen, and one possessed of a pair of glowing red eyes, just like the Newgate Prison creature. On several more occasions, in both 1729 and 1730, the dog returns, always seemingly intent on harassing the Souter family. It was, however, in late November 1730 the affair came to its end. Once again, this mysterious creature manifested before the farmer. But this time, according to the story, it was heard to speak, and it directed William to make his way to a specific nearby piece of ground within the next 30 minutes. Well, he did as he was told, and there waiting for him was the spectral hound of hell. Terrified William pleaded with it to tell him what was going on, and the hideous creature answered that he was none other than David, William's brother, and he'd killed a man at the very spot 35 years before. As David had directed his own savage dog to kill the man, David himself, as punishment, had been turned into a dog. Dogman instructed William to seek out the buried bones of the murder victim and put him inside consecrated ground, which William, of course, did, in the confines of the old Blair churchyard. And the ghostly black dog, which was supposedly the spirit of David Souter, vanished. His work was done. It never made a reappearance. Well, in history, there have been a number of figures who have been known for one thing or another. One of those is Peter Stube. 1590, George Borges wrote a fascinating but horrific report on one of the most notorious cases of lycanthropy on record. It discussed the story of a deranged and homicidal man named Peter Stube. Stube, S-T-U-U-B-E, went on murderous killing sprees, while, according to what he said, in the form of a terrifying werewolf. Well, according to what Bors wrote, in a town of Kepperot and Belder, near Collin in High Germany, there was continually brought up and nourished one Stube Peter, who from his youth was greatly inclined to evil and the practicing of wicked arts even from 12 years of age till 20. And until his dying day, insomuch that surfeiting in the damnable desire of magic, necromancy, and sorcery, acquainted himself with many infernal spirits and fiends, insomuch that forgetting the God that made him and the Savior that shed his blood for man's redemption. In the end, careless of salvation, he gave both his soul and body to the devil. Well, in return, according to what Bors wrote, the devil pledged to provide Stu with whatever his heart desired during his mortal life. Well, he didn't want money. He didn't want success. In fact, he didn't want any external or outward pleasure. He wanted to be able to work his malice on men, women, and children in the shape of some beast, so he could live without dread or danger of life and unknown to be the executor of any bloody enterprise that he meant to commit. In other words, the devil promised to turn him into a werewolf. Well, according to Bors, the devil perceived Stube as being someone who was a fit instrument to perform mischief as a wicked fiend pleased with the desire of wrong and destruction. So he gave Stube a girdle, which when he put it around his waist, mutated him into the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf. And there's been a number of other stories I've read where supposedly those who turned into werewolves had a girdle of some sort. It was then, having been given the ability to transform himself into a monster, he went on to commit his gruesome acts. He executed in the most heinous manner possible quite a number of murders. If anybody displeased him, he would wait until they were by themselves and he would attack and kill them. Now, in werewolf form, it said Stube had more than just murder in mind when it came to the women of the area. If he chanced to spy a company of maidens playing together or milking their cows, it's a lot of that's where the term milkmaid came from. In his wolfish shape, he would run among them, and while the rest escaped by flight, he would grab one, and after he had fulfilled his lust, he'd murder her. If he'd known any of them, he would single them out. Well, when he was captured, he was put on the rack in the town of Bedburg. But not wanting to be tortured, he voluntarily confessed and made known the villainies he'd committed for the space of 25 years. And he told about how, by sorcery, he procured of the devil a girdle. And after he had had some space been imprisoned, the magistrates found out through the examination of the matter that his daughter Stube Bell and his gossip Catherine Tropin were both accessory to the murders. So they were all condemned and, of course, eventually put to death, which is what's supposed to have ended his reign of terror. Now, for those who have read Arthur Conan Doyle's classic, The Hound of the Baskervilles, few people can forget those immortal words uttered by
Dr. James Mortimer to the world's most famous fictional detective. Mr. Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound. So it may come as a surprise to some people to learn that Conan Doyle's novel was actually based on the real legends of a giant devilish hounds that were said to haunt Britain's villages and countrysides. In fact, Britain has a long, rich, and varied history of encounters with what have generally become known as phantom black dogs. Usually much larger than normal dogs, these creatures are said to possess a pair of large glowing eyes. Usually they're described as red. They frequent graveyards, old roadways, crossroads, and bridges, and almost unanimously associated with the realm of the dead. In some cases, these creatures appear to be demonstrably evil. In other reports, there's evidence that they have a helpful, even concerned nature. But whatever they may be, they are not your average flesh and blood animal. In fact, many have said they may be your worst nightmare. Now, while the image of the phantom black dog is most associated with the British Isles and mainland Europe, the beast has been seen in many other locales, including throughout Latin America. The leading researcher in this field is a man named Simon Birchall, the author of Phantom Black Dogs in Latin America. 38 pages long, the book is obviously very much a booklet rather than a full-length book, but that doesn't detract from the most important thing about it. Its pages are packed with case after case, each offering the reader a little-known and seldom-seen information on a definitive Latin American cousin to Britain's more famous counterpart. Now, notably, Birchall's publication details the truly startling wealth of similarities between these creatures seen centuries ago in England and those reported throughout Latin America in the last 100 years. They have diabolical, glowing eyes, the association that the phantom hound has with life after death, how seeing the beast may be a precursor to doom and tragedy, its occasional helpful and guiding qualities, the fact the animal is usually witnessed in the vicinity of bridges, crossroads, and cemeteries, the fact it can shape-shift and change in size, and not forgetting the most important aspect, its perceived paranormal origins. There doesn't seem to be much dispute that these creatures come from another realm. He also talks about the legend of the phantom black dog of some South American nations, such as Guatemala, have been exploited by those with draconian and outdated morals. For example, there are widespread tales of people who enjoy having a drink, or several, and curing the dire wrath of the phantom black dogs. And the Catholic Church used this legend and others as moralizing tales to try to limit people from drinking. Now, winged hounds, whose appearance and activities smack strongly of the chupacabra of Puerto Rico, are discussed in this work, as are copious amounts of data that make clear a link with tales of truly dark and satanic nature. And there's data suggesting at least some of the tales of the black dog might be based upon cultural memories. And stories of very real, large, ferocious hounds brought to the New World by the conquistadors, which were turned loose on the Indians of South America. That being said, though, it's clear that the overwhelming majority of reports of the phantom black dogs in Latin America parallel those of Britain to a truly striking, extraordinary degree. In a sense, they appear to be something other than flesh and blood entities. Now, I mentioned the chupacabra. Let's talk about the chupacabra. Now, there's a phenomenon known as the Texas chupacabra, which is apropos since I'm in Texas. These are admittedly very strange-looking, hairless beasts that have predominantly been reported within wooden fields in and around Austin and San Antonio. Now being seen with increasing frequency in the vicinity of Dallas. Now, one of the questions that keeps on surfacing regarding these creatures, did these mysterious beasts manage to migrate from the island of Puerto Rico? Well, the chupacabra reports began to surface in the mid-1990s. Now, while Puerto Rico is most
infamous monster may well share its name with the creature that haunts the woods, ranches, and wilds of Texas. That's pretty much where the connection ends. There's nothing but outright disappointment in trying to follow that particular path. Now, there have been a number of expeditions to Puerto Rico by researchers in search of the island's blood-sucking beast, and there's no doubt that they do exist. Numerous ranchers, veterinarians, civil defense employees, and members of the public have either seen the creatures or been witness to their blood-sucking activities. In most cases, the chupacabra of Puerto Rico are described as bipedal creatures with large eyes, vicious claws and teeth, hairless monkey-like bodies, a row of spines running down the backs of their head and neck, and even occasionally sporting membranous bat-like wings. And as for their mode of attack, most of the interviewees stated that the chupacabra killed their prey by a bite to the neck and then proceeded to drink the blood. But in Texas, there's something very different at work. In each and every case on record, the Texas chupacabra most certainly not described as being bipedal in nature. They walk on all fours. No wings, no huge eyes, no spikes running down their heads and necks. But that doesn't mean that there's not strangeness. It most certainly is, if you look carefully at these reports. In most cases where research has been able to secure the body of a Texas chupacabra, either after it's been shot or hit by a vehicle, DNA analysis has proven these creatures have canine origins. I mean, certainly they look weird, but they are from the dog family. Of that, there's no doubt. Now, the story didn't end there, though. They may be canine according to their DNA, but they're most certainly not normal canines. The lack of hair has led many commentators to suggest the animals are afflicted by mange, which certainly may be an issue. However, not only are we now seeing pups with the adult features, but young and old all seem to be adapting quite well to living without hair. There's none of the usual intense itching and scratching that's typical of animals affected by mange, and the lack of hair doesn't appear to have any bearing on their ability to roam quite happily through the woods and fields. In addition, in some cases, the front legs of the animals appear to be much shorter than one would consider normal, which gives them a weird hopping kangaroo-style gait. Others have elongated upper jaws, many have cataracts, and they act in a highly aggressive nature around people, which is quite unlike normal wild canines, which were usually steer clear of humans. And then there's the mode of their attack, which a number of ranchers have said involves biting in the neck of farm animals and the sizable amount of blood drained from the bodies. And it's this latter point, and this point alone, that's led people to believe that the Puerto Rican chupacabras and Texas chupacabras are of the same breed, but they're certainly not. So we got two distinctly different phenomena. One's born out of sightings of and encounters with truly unknown beasts on the island of Puerto Rico, and the other's focused upon weird-looking Texas canines that may have some extraordinary changes going on a genetic level as well. And if it's not enough that we have mutated dogs, let's talk about werecats. Now, throughout history, folklore, and mythology, one can find accounts of shape-shifting creatures. The most famous, of course, is the ubiquitous werewolf. The deadly monster of the full moon is far from being alone, though. In Africa, there are legends of werehyenas. Were-rats have been reported in Oregon. Xanthrophobia is a condition in which a person believes he or she can shape-shift into the form of a dog. And then there are werecats. Now, stories about werecats exist in a lot of locations around the planet. South America, Asia, Africa, Europe. Sometimes the werecats are nothing less than transformed humans. leopards, lions, tigers, and jaguars are typically the werecat forms in which human shapeshifters mutate. Others are regular cats, altered by dark magic into something hostile and terrible. But let's talk about the werecats of Britain. The earliest cases in regard to these werecats come from 1953, specifically August. The initial location is Abbots Bromley, a village in the English county of Staffordshire, the origins of which date back to about 940 A.D. The witness was a now-deceased man named Brian Kennerly. He often spoke of the occasion when, as he walked through the Abbots Bromley on what was a warm summer night, he was confronted by a large black cat that he described as a typical Black Panther. And as he said, not surprisingly, he was frozen in his tracks. And he said his amazement turned outright fear when the beast suddenly got up onto its back limbs, which gave it a height of about 5.5 feet. And it issued a low growl, flicked its front paws in his direction. A few seconds later, the creature dropped back to the ground and bounded out of sight. Now, a similar report, which came from the village of Blakeney in the English county of Norfolk, occurred in 1967. In this particular case, the witness is driving through the village on a cold winter's night, caught a brief glimpse of a creature standing at the side of the road that was eerily similar to the one seen by Brian Kennerly 14 years before. According to the driver, it stood like a person but stooped, but had a cat's head, even the pointed ears. Then there was a 1981 case and one in 1988. But the location was the same. The German War Cemetery, located within the heavily wooded Cannock Chase that we talked about before. This area has long been a hotbed for weirdness, Bigfoot-type creatures, werewolves, huge serpents, ghosts, UFOs, and an entire litany of supernatural creatures. And as for the two reports of werecat creatures seen at the cemetery, one was a daytime event involving a creature that was black in color, taller than the average man, seen leaning on one of the graveside stones, till it realized it was being watched, and it dropped on all fours and raced off into the trees. Second case concerned a van driver crossing the chase late at night and who was forced to bring his vehicle to a halt as a result of the presence on the road of a huge black cat. It was a cat that stared intently at the shock driver until it sort of jumped onto its back legs. Then it headed towards the cemetery, making a curious hopping and bouncing movement as it did so. So you have to ask yourself, are werecats really roaming the British Isles? Been a lot of reports. Yet the witnesses in the case of Brian Kennerly and his family especially was adamant that they encountered a large black upright cats that displayed vaguely human characteristics. Maybe the myths and legends aren't just folklore. Well, let's talk about the werewolf of Klein Krams. The year was 1879. Karl Bosch wrote that in the vicinity of Klein's Krams near Ludwigslust, Germany, there exists an earlier century's huge wood. It was so rich with game that the dukes often came to this region to hold their great hunts. And during these hunts, they almost always saw a wolf who, even though he came within shooting distance, could never be killed by the huntsman. Indeed, they even had to watch as he took a piece of game before their very eyes, and which, frankly, was something they considered most remarkable, and ran with it into the village. Well, according to Barsch, on one particular occasion, a hooser from Ludwigslust was making his way through the village to meet with a man named Fieg, when an unnamed hooser
When the unnamed Hooser arrived at the home of the man in question, he got far more than he imagined. When he entered the house, a flock of children stormed out of the house with a loud cry and hurried out into the yard. When he asked them about their what was going on, they told him that except for a small boy, no one from the Fink family was at home, and he, as was his custom when he was at home, had transformed himself into a werewolf, and they were running away from him because he was going to bite them. According to Bartsk, the much-feared wolf boy appeared at the door, but is now back in his human form. So the Hooser demanded the child tell him what manner of deviltry was afoot in the village. And although the boy was initially reluctant to say anything, he finally relented and said that his grandmother had a strap, and if he put it on, he'd instantly become a wolf. So the Hooser asked the boy to make an appearance as a wolf, and at first he didn't want to, but he finally agreed, and he asked that the man climb up in the loft so he'd be safe, and so he climbed up in the loft and pulled up the ladder, and the boy ran into the main room and came out as a young wolf and chased away all those who were standing in the entryway. After the wolf ran back into the main room and came back out as a boy, the Hooser climbed down and had the fig child show him the magic belt. But he couldn't see anything unusual about him. Well, in no time at all, the astonished and concerned Hooser went to a forester in the vicinity of Klein Krams and told him what he experienced at the fig house. After hearing the tale, the forester said, immediately thought about the werewolf that couldn't be wounded. And he now thought that he would be able to kill the werewolf. So on the next hunt, the forester told his friends, as he very openly inserted a silver bullet into the barrel of his rifle, "Today the werewolf will not escape from me." Well, the hunt began. Didn't take long before the wolf showed himself once again. Many of the huntsmen shot at him, but he remained unwounded, and finally approached the forester who brought him to the ground. Everyone could see the wolf was wounded, but he jumped up and ran into the village. The huntsman followed him, but the werewolf outran him and disappeared into the Feig farmyard. There was an unforeseen ending to this strange saga, though. The werewolf killed by the forester was not the young Feig boy, after all. In their search, the huntsmen came into the house where they found the wolf in the grandmother's bed. In fact, they recognized it from the tail that was sticking out from under the covers. The werewolf turned out to be none other than Fig's grandmother. In her pain at being shot, she'd forgotten to take off the strap and in this manner revealed her secret. So the question becomes, there's so many stories about straps and girdles and what have you. There must be some basis in fact. Well, Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm, better known as the Brothers Grimm, were born in Hanau in Germany. Jacob in 1875 and Wilhelm in 1876. And they're renowned for their popularization of folklore, myth, and legends, and for promoting the likes of Rapunzel and Cinderella, Hansel and Gretel, and Rumpelstiltskin. But they also had an interest in telling stories of werewolves. According to one of the stories they wrote, a soldier related the following story, which is said to have happened to his grandfather. The grandfather had gone into the forest to cut wood with a kinsman and a third man. People suspected there was something not quite right about this third man, although nobody could say exactly what it was. Three finished their work and they were tired. Third man suggested they sleep a little bit, and that's what they did. They all lay down on the ground, but the grandfather only pretended to sleep, kept his eyes open a crack. Third man looked around to see if the others were asleep, and when he thought they were, he put on a belt of some sort and turned into a wolf. But he didn't look like a natural wolf, but somehow different. Then he ran to a nearby meadow where a young foal was grazing, attacked it, and ate it, including the skin and the hair. Then he came back, took off the belt, laid down as before, returned to human form. Then a while later, they all got up together and made their way home. Just as they reached the town gate, the third man complained he had a stomachache. Grandfather whispered in his ear, I can well believe for somebody who has a horse, complete with skin and hair in his belly. Third man replied, if you said that to me in the forest, you wouldn't be saying it to me now. There's another story about a woman who taken on the form of a werewolf and attacked the herd of a shepherd who she hated, caused a lot of damage. But the shepherd wounded the wolf in the hip with an axe blow and it crawled into the brush. Shepherd followed, thinking he'd finish it off, and he found a woman sitting there using a piece of cloth torn in her dress to stop the blood gushing from the wound. In the year 1610 at Ludish, two sorcerers were executed because they had turned themselves into werewolves and killed a lot of children. With them, they had a boy of 12 whom the devil turned into a ravenous, to a raven whenever they were tearing apart eating their prey. So there's a lot of stories. You have to ask yourself, where these stories all originated? In 1898, F. Asmus and O. Knopp wrote that by using what was called a wolf strap, it's possible just about anybody to transform his or herself into a werewolf. However, if somebody were to call the werewolf by their human name, they'd transform back into a human form. And as for what exactly a wolf strap was, the only comment was it was a gift from the devil. And it was said that a person who possessed such a strap couldn't get rid of it, even if he wanted to. Anybody who had accepted a wolf strap had entered into brotherhood with the devil, surrendering body and soul to him. Now, if real wolves were feared in earlier times, werewolves are feared all the more. A real wolf could be shot dead or lured into a wolf pit where it would perish from hunger. But a werewolf couldn't be brought down with a rifle bullet, and it wouldn't fall into a wolf pit. So the question became, what is the use of running around as a werewolf? Their final answer was it wasn't done for no good reason. When the pantries and meat containers are empty, one could only have to fasten on the wolf strap, run off as a wolf, seek out a fat sheep that was wandering off toward the edge of the woods, creep toward it, seize it, and drag it into the woods. In the evening, one could bring it home without anybody noticing. Or the werewolf would know when a peasant was going through the woods with a lot of money. He could ambush him, rob him, run off across the fields with the stolen loot. In earlier times, according to the pair, and after the horses had been unhitched from wagon or prowl, they'd be driven out to a community pasture where they'd be watched until morning by two herdsmen. Even colts were put out for the night. People took turns watching after him. And there was a good reason for this. They were concerned the horses had become the victims of the werewolves in their very midst. They knew they were there, but there was no way to find them. In a century-long past, in a valley in the Fetchel Mountains, Bavaria, Germany, according to Alexander Schlappner, a shepherd was tending his flock in a green meadow. The year was 1874. Several times it happened after driving his herd home, he discovered that one of the animals was missing. On each and every occasion, the search for the animals ended in complete failure. On one occasion, though, the shepherd spied a huge wolf-like animal stealthily exiting the woods and attacking and quickly killing a small lamb. Shepherd gave chase, but it wasn't quick enough. The wolf thing was nearly instantaneously gone, as was the unfortunate lamb. Well, the shepherd came up with a plan. Next time he took an expert marksman with him. The wolf approached, but the marksman's bullets bounced off of him. Then it occurred to the hunter to load his weapon with a dried pith from an elder bush. Next day he got off a shot, and the wolf ran howling into the woods. Next morning, the shepherd met an old neighbor woman who was not on the best of terms. Noticing she was limping, he asked her, "Neighbor, what's wrong with your leg? It doesn't seem to want to go along with you." The old woman eyed him for a moment and said, "What business is it of yours?" She didn't wait for an answer, but went on about her way. The shepherd took careful note of her reply, chiefly because the old woman had long been suspected of practicing magic. People claimed to have seen her on the Huberg in Swabia, the Kotterberg, and also the Huy in Halberstadt. He reported her. She was arrested, interrogated, and flogged with the rod of elderwood, with which others suspected of magic, but who had denied the charges had been punished. She was then locked up in chains. Suddenly she disappeared from the prison, and nobody knew where she went. That wasn't the end of the story, though. Sometime later, the shepherd encountered the wolf again on the fringes of the forest land and late at night. On this occasion, it wasn't the shepherd's animals the beast had come for. The beast wanted the shepherd himself. A violent battle between the two erupted, during which the shepherd gathered all his strength together against the teeth and claws of the ferocious beast. And despite the shepherd's determination to slay the creature, it quickly became clear he was overwhelmed when it came to the matter of sheer brute force and strength. And he would have died had it not been for a hunter who quickly happened upon the scene and fired a shot at the wolf and then struck it with his knife. Well, the instant the blood began to flow from the wolf's side, the old woman from the village appeared in the field in front of him. They finished killing her and buried her 20 feet beneath the earth. The place where they buried the woman, they erected a huge stone cross, which they named the Wolf Stone in memory of the events. It was never peaceful and orderly within the vicinity of that stone. There was always something, I guess you could say, unearthly going on. Well, it was a woman who, as a young girl, had a traumatic encounter with an infernal supernatural hound at the height of World War II. And she told a story. She said, "At the time, because of the war, my mother and I usually stayed with an elderly gentleman who had kindly taken us in as refugees from London. We only went back to the capital when the bombing ceased. The cottage where we lived is still in existence in Braden in Worcestershire. My encounter took place late one afternoon in summer when I had been sent to bed, but was far from sleepy. I was sitting at the end of the big brass bedstead playing with the ornamental knobs and looking out the window when I was aware of a scratching noise and an enormous black dog had walked from the direction of the fireplace to my left. It passed around the end of the bed toward the door. As the dog passed between me and the window, it swung its head around to stare at me. It had very large eyes which glowed from the inside as it lit up. And as it looked at me, I was quite terrified, much aware of the creature's breath, which was warm and strong as a gust of wind. The creature must have been very tall, as I was sitting on the old-fashioned bedstead, which was quite high, and her eyes were level. By the time it reached the door, though, it had disappeared. I assure you, I was wide awake at the time and sat for quite some time, wondering what I'd seen, to be truthful, too scared to get out of bed, or to get into the bed and go to sleep. I clearly remember my mother and our host sitting in the garden in the late sun, talking and hearing the ringing of the bell on the weekly fried fish van from Birmingham as it went through the village. I'm sure I wasn't dreaming. I never forgot the experience. I remember it to the last detail. So there's many things that exist that we have no knowledge of. Well, once again, we come to the end of another show. We'll be back on Monday. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great weekend.